have is Project Safe Neighborhoods. I don't know if anyone in the room has heard of Project Safe Neighborhoods. It's a $1.1 billion initiative by the Bush administration to reduce crime, gun crime in particular, throughout the United States. And the idea is that each one of the federal districts will get a certain pot of money to address gun crime as that district wishes. So in Chicago, Andrew Papakristos and Jeff Fagan and I are the research partners. And what we've done is to work with a multi-jurisdictional and multi-level task force to think about strategies for reducing gun crime. Okay, so I'm going to turn off the light, and we'll try this PowerPoint, which is the first time I've ever done this. So we'll see how it goes. Usually what I do with PowerPoints is makes overhead slides, which is really kind of a waste of the use of technology, I guess, but that's what I know how to do. Okay. So, in the Northern District of Illinois, which of course covers beyond Chicago, we've decided to focus on a very targeted area, a map I'll show you in a second, on the west side of Chicago, which is the highest crime police district in the city. And the task force includes the Chicago Police Department, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is basically the coordinating agency, the State's Attorney's Office, the Illinois Department of Corrections, which is really a key player for reasons that you'll see shortly, Cook County Probation, not so much a key player, various city officials, and lots of community organizations. And basically, this group of people got together, sat around a table, and figured out a few things. First of all, where we ought to train the bulk of the resources, and second, how to do it, what we should do. All right, so here's the basic problem. There are lots of homicides in Chicago, and most of them are homicides coming out of, resulting from guns, and used often by gangs on the west side. Now, here's the situation where we were beginning. Now, interestingly, I don't know, probably most of you weren't here when this started. In 2002, Chicago was designated the murder capital of the United States. It's kind of interesting. It was based on the fact that we had over 600 homicides in one year. Now, of course, as you see from this graph, what's really interesting about that is if we're over 600, we're down here, right? And just look back 10 years ago, we were up almost at 1,000 homicides, and at the point that we were pretty close to 1,000, no one ever called Chicago the murder capital of the United States, which kind of gives you a sense of what's happening in all the rest of the cities in the country, right? The point that we're at 600, New York has dropped its homicide by just dramatically. Los Angeles, not so dramatically, still lower than Chicago. And the final point to note about this slide is that this idea of the murder capital is based on actual counts. But that's not the experience of crime that people feel, right? That would be a rate on how many homicides per 100,000. So at this time, about 2002, our homicide rate was about 22 to 23 per 100,000. Just as a point of comparison, New York was about 7 per 100,000 at that point. Okay, this gives you a sense of the composition of homicides over time. As you can see, trending downward, and by and large, the gang homicides are staying pretty stable. Okay, here we go. This is the fun graph. This is the reason why we decided to focus on this area on the west side. So the green dots are homicides. The color coding you see are ATF gun seizures. So the redder the little square is, the more guns ATF recovered. Right? And you can see over here, lots and lots of guns. And over here, lots of guns too, also a lot of homicides. We decided to use the south side of Chicago, including Inglewood, which you've probably been hearing a lot about in the news lately, as our control district. The west side of Chicago was the treatment area. Which one's this? This just gives you some more information about what the crime indicators look like. As I said, at the time that we started, the homicide rate for the city of Chicago was 22 per 100,000. But look at the control beats and the PSN beats. we're talking a homicide rate in the PSN beats on the west side of 75 per 100,000, right? That's like the homicide rate in some third world countries and New Orleans, in the worst parts of New Orleans, actually. So the lesson here is that this number, 22 per 100,000, is pretty much being driven by what's happening on the west side. We reduce gun crime on the west side, we can reduce the homicide rate in the city overall. Okay, so what did we do? Tried to come up with lots of different strategies. Some strategies aimed at offenders, some strategies aimed at the public at large. Just briefly, the Bush administration basically wanted the U.S. attorneys in each of the districts to focus on federal prosecutions of people who shouldn't have guns. Some of you, maybe all of you know, that if you are a convicted felon in the United States, even if it's a state felony, that you are not allowed to have a gun or have ammunition, right? And if you are caught with a gun or with ammunition, you are subjected to very severe federal penalties. So the idea was, look, we'll go after the people who aren't supposed to have guns, felons, and we will subject them to a higher number of federal prosecutions and send them to prison for a long time. The idea behind this came out of a project in Richmond called Project Exile. It was called Exile because the people who were sent to federal prison were actually sent to federal prisons far away from home, hence exile. And the idea was is this was supposed to heighten the deterrent factor and make people decide not to carry guns. Our strategy was a little different. As I speak about our strategy, you can look at the flowchart, which I think is pretty explanatory. There was some research showing, for those of you who are really into the econometrics of it, I recommend a paper by Jens Ludwig and Steve Levin, that Project Exile didn't work, right? Basically, what the officials in Richmond did was to say, look, before we started Exile, crime was really high. After Exile, crime went down. But as you can see from the graphs that I showed you before, it's likely, right, that crime was just trending downward in Richmond anyway, just as it's trending downward in Chicago. So you have to do more than just sort of a before and after the timeline test to show that you're making a difference. One of the things that Jens Ludwig did was to look at juvenile homicides and show that basically that they were also going downward, right? And you wouldn't sort of expect any federal initiative to affect what juveniles are doing because they're not subject to federal prosecution, which is evidence that exile isn't working. Steve Levitt said, there's no reason to expect whatever they're doing to work anyway. Why? Federal prosecution is extremely rare, and it's hard to ensure that your target population actually knows what's happening, right? The common experience is state prosecution. So any additional benefit you're going to get, it has to be over and above what the state prosecutors are already doing. There's no reason to think there was enough power behind what the federal prosecutors were doing. We took that lesson and had a conversation with Pat Fitzgerald, and I said, Pat, why is it that you think that an increase in federal prosecutions is going to work? And he said, well, you know, we think that the people who are carrying the guns are going to be afraid of federal prosecutions. And I said, okay, why is it that you think that they're going to know what you're doing? And he had no answer. And so we came up with a strategy, and that is the offender notification meetings. We would come up with a one-hour meeting in which people who were recently released from prison would be told of the federal penalties by law enforcement officials, hence attention felons. But we also added an innovation to the meeting. We had an ex-offender who's changed his life around and who could give sort of a testimony about, I changed my life, you can too, to sort of motivate the participants. And finally, we had lots of community folks saying, look, you know, this is a choice. You can choose to go back to guns, or you can choose to turn your life around. We have drug treatment. We have community college. We have job training. You know, come with us and turn your life around. And in a moment, I'll tell you how we have assessed the effectiveness of that. We also still had the federal prosecutions and the increase in the length of prison sentences. And also, we had these gun teams who were going out and taking guns off the street. Okay, so here's the lineup. Increased federal gun prosecutions, supposed to probably, we think, from a theoretical standpoint, deter people from carrying guns. Increased federal prison sentences could also be deterrence, but the most straightforward way of thinking about what it does is it incapacitates these guys because the prison sentences are very long. Increased firearm policing, taking the guns off the street. You just basically take away a very lethal technology away from people so that they can't use that lethal technology in a situation in which they can kill someone. Instead of a gun, we hope that they use a knife or a fist, right? It's not reducing the number of transactions, but it is making those transactions less lethal and hence, hopefully, less likely to result in homicide. And finally, these offender notification meetings. Deterrence, sure, but we also think possibly normative change. Why? Well, the setup of these meetings is not what you'd expect. It's not a kind of audience of offenders and podium of important people. Everyone is on the same plane, and it's at a round table format. And the we told the law enforcement people to take care not to sort of yell and scream at them, you know, don't threaten them. Basically make it a straightforward, you have a choice. If you pick up a gun, this is what we're going to do. If you don't, then you have these other options. It's all up to you. So our idea, right, is that basically by respecting the agency of these folks, that perhaps we're increasing the legitimacy of government and law enforcement in their eyes and motivating them to choose to obey the law in the way that you or I would obey the law. We don't obey the law because we're afraid that the police are going to pick us up. We obey the law because we think it's the right thing to do. All right. I'm going to go through this one pretty quickly because I don't know how much you care about exactly how we did this. And for those of you who are really into the econometrics of it, you can get the paper on SSRN. But what we did was a quasi-experimental panel design, right? So we're not randomly assigning any kind of treatment to the treatment area. We basically have a treatment area, which is the highest crime police district in Chicago, and we have a near-equivalent control group on the south side. Remember the map. And we use a multi-level strategy. That is that we looked at each particular police beat and we allowed it to vary within the beat and then between the beats, okay? I don't care about that. okay. So here's the important stuff. Offender notification meetings, how do we measure it? There's going to be a pool of eligible people in each beat, right? The people who are leaving prison. And we measure the dosage of that treatment, basically, by the percent of eligible offenders in each beat who have attended a meeting, okay? Federal prosecution, straightforward, the number of prosecutions in the beat, it's logged, but you don't really care about that. Federal prison sentence, or as a person-month sentence, essentially. Gun seizures, number of guns. And then we also did an index because sort of the dosage of each one of these things varies among beats. And so we wanted to have some way of measuring the extent to which each beat was getting the kinds of treatments, right? So some beats are getting a lot of everything. Some of them are just getting federal prison sentences. Some of them are just getting gun seizures. Now think about why that would be true. There's no way that in the city of Chicago, ATF is going to suddenly stop seizing guns, you know, from the rest of the city and only focus on our area. They're going to keep seizing guns all over the city. So ATF gun seizures, the dosage is all across the city of Chicago. So too with the federal prison sentences and prosecutions, although they are sort of concentrated in our areas, the offender notification meetings are pretty much only in our treatment areas. Okay. So we're beginning to see some results here. PSN begins here, and one of the things you should notice is that the slope, remember that from geometry, is going is much steeper in the PSN group than it is in the control group and certainly in other areas of the city. So that's one indication that whatever's happening in the PSN area is different, right, from what's happening in other areas, and it's more effective. Oh, let's forget about that one. Okay. This one is a smoothed curve. This band it gives you the sort of idea of how the PSN strategy was ramped up. So the first prosecution occurred way before we had the first parolee form. But again, one of the things you see is that the slope of the change is much greater after that time period than before. But remember, I was just complaining about Project Exile in Richmond, saying you don't just want to show what's happening before and after. You ought to control for some things. Otherwise, someone like me will say, you know, it's just regression to the mean and you're not showing us anything. This is basically the same graph as the other one, but a prettier graph. So you can actually see. The cool thing we like about this graph is that the actual treatment area crosses the control group, which is always a nice thing to see. Okay, so the summary of findings, because we took out the slides that have all of the math, but the forums actually have the largest effect on homicides. Prosecutions have a small effect, but it's still statistically significant. So do seizures and the additive index. Interestingly about the seizures, you take about 100 guns off the street and you can get a body, right? You save someone's life. So we thought that that was interesting. There is no significant effect, at least in our study, of the sentence length on homicides or any predictor on aggravated battery or ag assault. My guess about this one, before someone asks questions, but we can explore it, is that our measures of aggravated battery and aggravated assault are really what police do and not really what happens in the world, right? So arrests of aggravated battery just tell you how active police are rather than giving you a sense of how many batteries there really are, right? And this summary of findings, of course, takes into account our very sophisticated multi-level model where we're controlling for things like poverty and race and joblessness and all of the like. Okay, this is my favorite graph. That really gives you a visual picture of just how big the form effect is, right? Because we log things and the like, if I tell you that that each percentage increase in the PSN treatment is associated with an 18% decrease in the log homicide rate, you say, what? But if you look at this picture, right, you can get a sense, really, of how big that effect is. So this is the effect of the forums, we think, on homicide. This is the effect of gun recoveries. Of course, it's much smaller than the forums because we're talking about the units of guns, right? So you have to gather a lot of guns, basically, to get a unit increase. This is the effect of prosecutions. Sentence length, but that's not statistically significant. And this is the index, the additive effect of all of these things. Okay, so here's our conclusion. That is, the observed hot drop in homicide is larger in the treatment area than the control area. You saw those graphs, 35%. We find a significant negative relationship between the various PSN interventions and homicide, and the forums appear to be having the largest effect. But there's also an additive effect. That is, that you do get more bang for your buck if you do forums and something else, right? Like the federal prosecutions and getting the guns, et cetera. All right, finally. Oh, not that. Well, yeah, you can get that paper. I thought that we had the what's happening next slide, but maybe not. Have I reached the end of my PowerPoint ability? Big weakness in the study is that we're only using aggregate crime data, all right? So we know that crime has dropped in Chicago, and we're using statistical controls and the like to try to make a claim that it's PSN that's making a difference. But given that, it seems that the forums are having the biggest effect. I'm sure some of you are out there thinking, well, why don't you tell me whether or not the people who are actually attending the forum are recidivating? And I would if I could, but the Illinois Department of Corrections has not yet given us the data, even though we've been promised the data for 2 years. The argument has been there's some political wangling going on in Springfield, and after the election, they say, we should be able to get the data, so we're keeping our fingers crossed. In any event, it's probably not that big of a deal because recidivism is something you don't want to measure until you're 3 years out. That's when you pretty have all of your failures. And we'll be coming out on about 3 years with our first group at the end of
this year, right about the time that the election takes place. So we're still in good shape. The Chicago Gun Project is another project we have going on, which is, even if I could tell you that the individuals who went to the forum were not recidivating, some of you in the audience would say, okay, but why? Right? We don't know. Maybe it's that they're actually motivated by this law enforcement message. That's certainly what the U.S. Attorney's Office would like us to think, that it's all about the attention felons, right? Maybe they're changing their lives around. Maybe they're actually going to these community groups and getting drug treatment and job training, and maybe they're working in the life. Yeah. We don't know. Maybe it's about this idea of perceptions of legitimacy. That is, that we put a group that is much more prone than other groups to distrust legal authority, and we put them in a setting in which we encourage them to actually have more trust or at least recognize the legitimacy of government authority. Now, there's one thing I didn't mention about the offender notification meetings. We do not do it in a law enforcement setting. In addition to the kind of non-hierarchical setup that I mentioned before, we do it in a park. We actually do it in Garfield Park Conservatory. And if you haven't been to the conservatory, you should go before you leave Chicago if you're not from here. It's really a spectacular place. It's beautiful. And I think for many of those people, even though they've lived in Chicago for most, if not all, of their lives, it's the first time that they've ever been in a place that's that lovely. And, you know, the message that they're getting there is one basically of respect in a way that they don't usually get from that particular, from those particular speakers. So the role of the Chicago Gun Project is to try to assess those things through the use of a survey, which is right now out in the field. And I hope by the end of the year, right about the time we expect to get data from IDOC after the election, we'll have some results from the survey. Okay, let's see if I can figure out how to turn this light back on. Yay. All right, that's it. Any questions? Yes.
It seems like felons would have pre-crystallized ideas about law enforcement already, and so I'm wondering if you can talk more specifically about what you think is happening in these meetings that's changing their message. And I'm also curious if you see a difference in response between first-time felons and repeat felons.
Yeah, okay. So the idea about them having more crystallized ideas about law enforcement, I think, works in our favor. In the following way. One of the things that people are often surprised about by this research is that the treatment is only 1 hour, right? And so if we're getting this impact, as the models seem to suggest, we're getting an impact from 1 hour in the lives of people who, you know, some could describe as pretty hardened criminals. You know, that's hard to believe, I think, to put it bluntly. There are two reasons why we think it could have an effect. There's some work in social psychology showing that 1 hour treatments for children in not very good schools in Washington, D.C., have lasting effects throughout the year. That is, when it comes to a kind of psychological intervention like that, if the legitimacy aspect is what's working for us here, that there is some work suggesting that you could have a large effect even with a very small treatment. So that's one. Two, the reason why I think it might work is that because they have such crystallized opinions, or I don't want to call crystallized, but at least hardened opinions of law enforcement officers, that this kind of intervention for them is very much unexpected. All right? So if most of the people in this room went to Garfield Park Conservatory, where you may have been before, or you're used to seeing those kinds of places, right? And a law enforcement officer spoke to you respectfully and told you that, you know, you shouldn't carry a gun, and then other people gave you information about other options. There's nothing extraordinary about that for you. And I think it's because, or at least the theory would be, because this situation is so far removed from their normal dealing with these people,
that there is reason to think that it could have an effect. But again, I can't be sure until we do something like the Chicago Gun Project, or at least look at the recidivism numbers to look at behavior, neither of which I have. This is all theoretical at this point, where the Washington, D.C. studies help me from a theoretical standpoint. It has been done with a very small intervention and with a group of people whom you would think that a very small intervention wouldn't, you know, have their test scores jump through the place, but it did, right? And that was in a pure experimental design. So that's the reason why I think it could have an effect. But, you know, I'm not sure. You know, that more work needs to be done on that, definitely. Is that both of your questions?
Okay, in other words, just if you see a difference between, I'm not sure how do people find out about the meetings you see that set for.
Right. So I can't answer that question because I don't have the individual level data yet. But the way that people find out about the meetings is when they are released from prison, their parole officers are given from a central location a list of people who are supposed to attend the meetings, who are randomly chosen. The parole officer does not choose them. That we have a guy, Marvin. He doesn't even have a title. Marvin. Marvin the guy at IDOC, who looks at the pool of eligible attendees, selects those people at random, informs their parole officers, and then the parole officer tells them that they have to attend. Now, I'm sure there are some of you in this room thinking, well, it's probably just a self-selection effect, right? That the people who are attending the forums are the people who are less likely to offend, and that might be why we're getting that impact. So I'd say two things. One, I'm not looking at recidivism numbers to give you these results. But two, we have 99% compliance. Now, how are the parole officers getting them to come? They can't be violated. Violated means sent back to prison for the failure to do what your parole officer says, essentially. They can't be violated for the failure to attend one of these meetings. And as best we can tell, the parole officers simply tell them to go, and they do. and I'm not sure why. Maybe they think that they'll be violated. Again, though, gives me pause, right? Because to the extent that they think that they're violated and the parole officers tell them to go, then it could be that they think that the parole officers are watching them, right? We're pretty sure that the parole officers aren't doing anything different than they normally do, which is pretty much nothing. But that doesn't mean that the people don't think that, right? So to the extent that they think that they're being watched, maybe that changes their behavior. Again, all of these things are going to be easily answered once I get the individual level data, because I'll know who their parole officers are, and I'll know which people who attended the forums are what they're doing, whether they're recidivating or not. Yeah?
I was wondering how well you think this might transfer outside of Chicago. If you were going to apply, it seems like you can come up with maybe like guidelines for how these forums would be run, and if you think that those should have a lot of detail and explanation for their cities, or if they leave a lot of wiggle room, makes it easier to adapt.
All right. So what's today? Everything is sort of a blur. We were in Denver earlier this week, and there was a national conference for all of the PSN research partners. And Chicago was far and away the most impressive. because we actually had results, right? And we had papers that have been submitted to peer-reviewed journals, and most of the other people measured their success in the fact that they had actually done more prosecutions. And we're like, okay, but how about more prosecutions, less crime? Can you do that? So that question came up. I think there are three things going on. One is the nature of the gun homicide problem. It turns out that in most other areas in this country, the gun homicide problem is a domestic violence problem, at least according to the people who came to this meeting in Denver, right? Which it presents a kind of quandary for the chosen method, or at least the method that the administration is pushing to deal with gun crime, right? If you think that your main problem is domestic violence, probably most of those people who have guns in their homes have guns legally, or a good number of them. Right? So they're not going to be affected by this Project Exile type strategy. Right? So there's a mismatch right there. That suggests, right, that whatever you do, you really have to assess what your problem is. And the gun crime problems vary widely throughout the country. So let's sort of get rid of 80 to 90% of the country and then focus on, not 80 to 90% by population, but just by the number of federal districts. Now, would this work in Los Angeles? Would it work in New York? Would it work in New Orleans before Katrina? The main hurdle there is getting this multi-level task force to work. In a lot of cities, it's an understatement to say that the U.S. attorney and the state's attorney and the local police are best friends, right? Chicago is a very unique situation that everybody in that room got along well. They respected each other. They did not resent the leadership from the U.S. attorney's office. So even if the program was appropriate in New York or Los Angeles because of the nature of the problem, that is gangs and gun homicide, replicating the ability of this multi-level task force to work is far from easy. And I think the third issue is the nature of community supports. In Chicago, you know, we're known as a city of neighborhoods, and neighborhood organizations are extremely strong. That's not true, as best I can tell, although, you know, I'm hardly an expert on Los Angeles. I think that would be hard to do in Los Angeles. Probably more easily done in New York, but you'd still have to face the issue of the multi-level jurisdiction, which is critical because of the way in which each one of these government entities has control over different things. So Illinois Department of Corrections has control over parole, right? The Chicago police have control over the policing. The U.S. Attorney's Office has to decide that they're going to focus on something very local as opposed to something district-wide and the like. And those hurdles are kind of hard to overcome. Yes?
So the picture you showed of the homicide rates, it looked as though you mentioned you
might even be able to
focusing on gangs, but it looked as though the gang homicide rate was both significantly smaller than the overall homicide and not shrinking as much. So I guess I maybe have misread the graphs.
No, you didn't. Surprised. Okay, but remember, that would have been the entire city, right? So let's see if I can find it. Oh, my gosh. This would be going back to the beginning, right? I just went by it, didn't I? You're talking about the green and yellow.
Yeah.
Okay, what you don't see, I see it. Okay, do I need to turn off the light or can you see that?
No.
Okay, this is the entire city of Chicago, all right? So even though the rates in the west and south sides were, I think, 50 and 75 per 100,000 respectively, right? They're not like 50% of the homicides in the city of Chicago. So this counts domestic violence, this counts everything. It turns out, though, that in those particular areas, the gang homicides are a much larger percentage than in the other areas of the city of Chicago. So that by addressing what's happening in the gang homicides in that small area, see if I can find which graph, the gang homicides here, you can do something substantial about the homicide rate in that area. That's the area that has a 75 per 100,000 homicide rate. And by doing something substantial about this homicide rate here, you do something about the city's homicide rate overall. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I guess I was just surprised at the really steep slope of the non-gang homicide compared to the gang-related.
Yeah.
Especially given what looked like great results for just gang-related.
Well, the other thing is, too, that in the city of Chicago, we have a very conservative definition of what gang-related homicide is. right? So in Los Angeles, a gang-related homicide is any homicide done by somebody who they think is a gang member. So, for example, domestic violence. In Los Angeles, if a gang member, someone they say is a gang member, is involved in a domestic homicide, they'll call that a gang-related homicide. We don't in the city of Chicago. In fact, if it's a homicide over, let's say, a particularly lucrative corner for selling drugs, which is often a homicide of one gang member of another, we don't even call that a gang homicide.
Okay.
We call that a drug homicide. Gang homicides in Chicago are about sort of gang turf or gang beefs or something like that. So that should give you another sense of what's going on there. Did you have a question?
I guess my question is perhaps a little bit more mushy. What I'm sort of interested in what the input that was solicited and that was given by the community organization both and whether there's been any measure of the community response. And even whether this data has been shared with some of the community groups that were involved.
The data has definitely been shared with them. Absolutely. As far as their input, you mean in terms of what strategy ought to be chosen?
When they sat down at the table.
Yeah, they weren't there.
I'm sorry?
They were not there.
Who was invited?
Well, anybody that Pat Fitzgerald decided to invite. So, so that was mostly going back to this. Mostly all of these people, this community organization and AFTERS, they were consulted. They were consulted, but they weren't actually at the table when we decided to do the federal prosecutions and the like, and the parolee forms. Andrew and I, Jeff was in New York during all that time, sort of nominated ourselves as the people who were speaking for folks in the community, which is why I pressed Pat about this idea about why he thought federal prosecutions were going to work, because before the thing started, all they were going to do was more federal prosecutions and increased sentences. That's what they were going to do because that's what was done in Richmond, and it worked in Richmond, damn it. You know, I mean, that was really their view. And so the great thing about it, though, is that Pat Fitzgerald is a really smart man. He's also was a statistics major in college. So I would, at these early meetings, would come in and bring assigned reading, you know, no more than 10 or 12 pages of material for them to read. And he did. And it was actually impressed by the study that Jens Ludwig did about exile and found Steve Levitt's comment on Jens's piece very compelling. And given that they were going to do federal prosecutions, you know, the question was, how they were going to do it in a way that was effective. And, you know, I got them to sort of buy into the idea that it will be working, right? If these offender notification forms work in the way that they thought it was going to work, that is, conveying the information to the target population to get them to fear the consequences of, you know, the federal government's actions such that they're going to stop engaging in bad acts. If the offender notification works in that way, then it would be very successful. The success could be measured in fewer federal prosecutions. You wouldn't have to, right? Because people would be obeying the law. And I have to say that one of our early analyses, not the ones I showed you here, but one of our early analyses showed that federal prosecutions didn't make any difference. Or I should say it this way, that the increase in the number of federal prosecutions made no difference. That is, for each additional federal prosecution, you got no more bang for the buck. Now, the analysis that we didn't do there was a kind of threshold analysis. How many federal prosecutions would you have to do to make a difference? But the analysis did show pretty clearly that you didn't just need to keep doing more and more federal prosecutions because it wasn't working anymore. The ATF guy at the table, when we presented that, was very upset. You're saying that federal prosecutions make no difference. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is an increase in the number doesn't make a difference. You're saying we went back and forth, and yeah, I just couldn't get him to understand what I was saying. Pat came into the room. I said it to Pat. He said, well, good. That means we can save money. you know, divert resources on there. And at which point I looked at ATF guy who, you know, wasn't saying anything. You know, it really works when you have somebody like Pat Fitzgerald at the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office, which goes back to your question, too. How many Pat Fitzgeralds do we have? One, sadly. And if there was Pat Fitzgerald at the head of every U.S. Attorney's Office, then, you know, I think we could probably be doing a lot of good when it comes to gun crime in big cities.
It seems like one thing that may affect compliance by these ex-felons is the fact that they're going back in the neighborhoods where, if they go back unprotected and don't carry weapons, they're going to be subjected. They become victims of crime. What are you guys going to try to ensure, give them a sense of security and ensure that they don't become victims of gang-related activity?
No, this is good. So Jeff Bagan, who's one of the research partners, has done a lot of work on that, kind of scripts in neighborhood gun carrying, as his paper is called. That is, people feel that they have to carry a gun, or at least have people think that they're carrying a gun, lest other people in their community think that they're, you know, a punk, at which point they're preyed upon, right? Because they're the easy mark. CPD would say what is being done is a lot more heavy-duty policing to keep people safer. Which I'm not sure that the people returning or anybody else actually would appreciate. I mean, I guess the thing that is being done is, to the extent that these offender notification forms are having an impact, the kind of impact that they're having could not be confined simply to the people who are coming out of prison. Okay? So, one of the things I said was, we don't know, and from a behavioral standpoint, what the people who are going to the offender forms are doing. All I know is that crime is dropping in Chicago, and it has been for a while, as you saw in that first graph, and that on the west side of Chicago, it's dropping precipitously. And we've done some statistical analysis that suggests to us that it's PSN. Our guess is that, that these offender notification forums are having a kind of inoculative effect, almost. That is, that to the extent that it's keeping those guys from carrying guns and getting involved in situations in which they would use a gun that would result in a homicide, it's also impacting other people who didn't go to the forum, because you wouldn't get that kind of a drop simply because the people who went to the forums are no longer carrying guns and killing people, right? So it's almost like a public health model. But again, we can't be sure about that until we do much more individual level analyses. But you know, we've seen models like that elsewhere, right? Vaccinations, the same thing, right? Everybody doesn't have to be vaccinated in order for measles not to break out in the city of Chicago. Enough people have to, right? And then other people don't get sick. It's kind of like that. So that's the long roundabout way of saying, to the extent that the people who come out of prison and go back to their neighborhoods notice that there's just less crime around, then hopefully they're even that much less likely to carry a gun and feel that they need to in order to protect themselves. Because they're not, right? The crime rates, at least on the west side of Chicago, is going way down. Inglewood is another story, but notice, Inglewood was our control area. They're not getting the offender notification forms right now. And maybe that's one of the things that should happen over there. Yes?
So how much more work do you think you'll do before Inglewood has its growth and goes to the south side?
There are some forums going on the south side. The problem on the south side has been that the community resources and the person at IDOC, we need another person at IDOC, basically, to, you know, the coordination that's involved in this is quite a bit. And he hasn't been able to do as many forums on the south side as they have on the west side, although they're happening. They're just not happening at the rate that they've happened on the west side. So my guess is hopefully by the end of the summer, when they've ramped up, that they'll reach much more of a saturation point. On the west side, we've almost reached a saturation point, that the percentage of eligible people who can go to the forum have gone. on the south side because a lot more people live there. I think we've only gotten something like 5% of the eligible people. So it's like one of those tipping point analyses, right? We haven't reached the level where we're going to get it, or the, where we're seeing an effect on the south side yet. Yes?
In finding the success in the forums, I'm wondering what you feel the practical implications should be of those findings in terms of how the gun homicides are, how charged, sentencing, things like that. And also if your findings change the way you feel, or what you feel should be implemented in terms of like deterrent effects and preventative measures taken to prevent these. Because it's sort of, the forums are sort of like after the fact, right? Like after the, you know, they charge in terms of
even so after the fact in the sense that they're already felons,
right?
Yes. Right. Okay, but remember the message is you are a convicted felon and you can't have a gun. Now before you're a felon, the message would be very different. It would be in the city of Chicago you can't have a gun, but you know, you could conceivably in a special circumstance get a license to carry a gun in Chicago. A convicted felon in the city of Chicago can't, right? So I guess I would say, in terms of preventive measures, I would go back to the strategies that are aimed not at the offenders, but at everybody else that we didn't talk about. Okay, so can you see this? All right, look at the white part. The total population, not the, most of the stuff I've been talking about is the gray part. So the total population got other kinds of treatments. So you might have actually seen some of these things. We have these billboards on the west and south sides of Chicago. There are the radio spots. So the name of the paper, Attention Felons, actually comes from a radio spot. And the radio spot goes, "Attention, felons." Like that. If you have a gun, you could be facing serious jail time. All right, so that's to everybody. We also have these signs on buses and in subways. There's a school program. I shouldn't say there is a school program. One of the sore spots of this has been the CAPS. There's a CAPS implementation officer who's been in charge of coming up with some kind of PSN strategy for juveniles that would be implemented in schools. Right. This was started in 2002. It is now 2006, and there is still no real official school program for reasons that are unclear to me, but that's really not my bailiwick. But that would be one strategy. We also have a community partner who does a program in schools, although that's not the official school part I was just talking about, called Hands Without Guns. And so they go into schools and they, you know, try to persuade people, kids, not to pick up guns, which goes along with your colleague's point about, you know, people feeling that they have to carry guns in order to feel safe in certain communities. We just now have gotten some data from Hands Without Guns. And, you know, we'll be analyzing it to see whether what they're doing is making any difference at all. But the population that it goes to the Hands Without Guns program are people, kids who have been picked up by the police at least once. So those would be the preventive strategies. I mean, there's a whole host of preventive strategies that you can think of, right, that aren't targeted specifically at guns and much more about how to think about it. The relationship between, you know, crime and community context and poverty and jobs and, you know, normative change in the life. You know, this has nothing to do with that.
Right.
Yeah. Yes?
Are you concerned in any way that maybe the felons are going to these meetings and giving the message that it's now very dangerous for them to do their criminal business in their neighborhood and thus going elsewhere, whether it be Inglewood or the suburbs or whatnot, to commit their crime?
Displacement. Yeah. Am I worried about that? No. And the reason why I'm not is because if you look at one of the guys on the team, Andrew Papachristos, is a gang expert. And he's done a lot of work on sort of the social and ecology of gangs. And one of the reasons why we can use the South Side
as our control group is because there is very little movement between folks on the west side and the south side. They belong to different gangs. There's a giant highway in between. You know, people don't really leave their neighborhoods, but particularly those guys don't. It's a totally different gang. The west side is, the south side is the vice lords, and the west side is the rangers, I think. My research actually focuses on the people who aren't gangs, so I don't really know the gang literature as well. But anyway, it would be pretty hard. Given their gang membership, for those guys to just decide that they were going to quit the west side and go to the south side. Actually more perilous for them than other people. So I'm not really that worried about that. But, you know, displacement is an important issue. We could have just displacement within the west side community, right? That's something to be concerned about. And we've done that analysis, and there doesn't seem to be. There was Marcia.
I'm curious that you talked about sort of the difference between gang areas and non-gang or gang crime and non-gang crime. A lot of the things you talk about seem to be very specific to gangs, particularly like the vaccination style effect.
Mm-hmm.
If you're part of a community of gun users, then you need to talk to some percentage of the method that gets out.
Right.
I was curious about the difference between your control group on the south side and on the west side, and the difference between the ATF numbers that you showed and the homicide numbers. The south side seems to have a lot more gun seizures, or at least a lot closer to the west side, but a lot less homicides. And I wonder how the work that you're doing affects populations that aren't large gun-carrying populations. Like, if we put this into place in Lincoln Park, do we have any effect at all with something
like that? Yeah, I don't know why you would. Right? I mean, that goes back to the first question about, you know, how replicable this is to other cities. And, you know, you can change it. How replicable is it to other areas in the city? I mean, the first thing you'd want to know is, to the extent that Lincoln Park has a gun crime problem, what is the nature of the gun crime problem? And my guess is that it's not gang homicides. You know, it could be domestics. And then what you would do, I think, is something fundamentally different. I mean, you know, the idea that people who are killing people in domestic violence context, especially when the guns are legal, would be affected by this message that, you know, you're a felon and therefore you don't have a gun. It just doesn't seem logical, right?
So is there anything other than gang-related gun crime that is affected by this?
Well, certainly more than gang-related gun crime is, I mean, because of the very narrow definition that Chicago uses, right? So drug homicides where people are fighting over lucrative turf could be affected, and we're expecting that it is. And probably, in some context, domestic violence in the south and west side, to the extent that those domestic homicides were done with illegal guns. Illegal in the sense that you're a felon and you can't have a gun, right? I mean, because of course, I guess I should backtrack in Lincoln Park. You know, nobody in the city of Chicago is supposed to have a gun. So, in that sense, I guess those guns would be illegal, but not because necessarily because the person is a felon who has it. Still, you know, it's not as hard to get a gun in the city of Chicago as you would think, even though no one in the city of Chicago is supposed to have a gun. All right, that was very convoluted, but I think the short answer is no, I don't really think that it would work. And I think a lot of it has to do with, I think the point that, what's your name?
Eva.
That Eva was getting at about, you know, what else is going on. Right, these areas that have really high gun crime, right, it's not just that they're, you know, there is a gang issue and there's gun crime. They're also incredibly poor. And the education level is incredibly low. And, you know, the jobless rate is incredibly high. I mean, I'm not talking about unemployment. I'm talking about joblessness, people who are not even part of the workforce and not looking for a job. On the west side is extremely high, which is part of the reason it gets to this issue of why are there so many more homicides on the west side as opposed to the south side. The south side of Chicago, while it does have its issues, it's not nearly as bad as the west side in that sense, which raises the issue of why we use the south side as our control group, because in a lot of ways, it's really not that similar. The west side of Chicago is sui generis in that sense, but that's why we called it a near equivalent control group, and we tried to control for that by us, you know, taking into account the issue of poverty rate and race and education level and joblessness and the like. Yes?
Counselor, if you could focus more on a little bit on what the expressed conscience of what the community organization is saying. I mean, is it informative? Is there a little bit of like shaming aspect to it? I mean, is it by how?
That's actually an interesting question too. That, you know, it might be one of the impacts that we might be getting is not only the fact that there might be this parole officer effect, but the fact that they show up. These are people who go back to communities from which they come. And it's really important part of our strategy to have community organizations from that community, right? And so, you know, there's a sense that the offenders could say, wow, you know, there are lots of people watching me. And one thing that I'm trying to do with this research is to assess whether the community partners, because that's what my work has focused on over the years, whether their activity is any different. Are they doing anything different? Is their attitude towards offenders any different? We had to work really hard with them to get them not to just yell at these guys, you know what I mean? So our first couple of dry runs, we didn't have any offenders in the room. We just had them sort of practicing and, you know, to an empty room. You're messing up the community. going on and on. I'm like, okay, now that you've got that out of your system, let's try again. What we want you to do is focus on what you can offer. And we try really, really hard to make it very even keel. You know, police officers are sort of look, this is deal. The community folks are like, you know, the law enforcement guys told you what would happen if you choose a gun again. We really hope you don't, and this is what we can offer you. You know, please come see us. And they pretty much just describe their programs. You know, describe how many beds they have for drug treatment or what the job training looks like. You know, how many slots they have. Nobody's actually being signed up, by the way, at the end of this. I mean, sometimes some of the guys go and talk to these guys, but it really is kind of informational, and they get a folder, and they leave. The only person who's at all emotional in this is the guy in the middle, the ex-offender who turned his life around. And in that sense, it really is kind of like an old-style, you know, it's like a testimony. It really is like a church testimony, right? How I saw the light and I've changed my life and you can too, kind of thing. It'd be interesting to know whether that was the most impactful aspect of the session. We don't know, and you know, you might be asking yourself, so why haven't I asked any of these people? And the reason why is there's this thing called the Institutional Review Board. At universities that is designed to keep researchers from having people involved in experiments where you pretend to shock people, you know, the famous Milgram experiment where there was a pretend shock and then there was an actor going, acting like they were really being shocked, but they weren't. And so the person who was, you know, ramping up the pain was, you know, psychologically damaged by that entire experience. And so we have a thing called the Institutional Review Board to keep people from doing that. And that Institutional Review Board does not allow us to talk to people who are paroled from prison because they are considered prisoners, even though they're not actually in prison. And because of that, they're not considered to be able to participate freely in our research, even though all I want to do is ask them, you know, so, what'd you think? So I'm not allowed to. And if the parole officers ask them, that can mess up with my research, right? Because suddenly, if the parole officer started acting like they cared and did things differently from the way that they usually do, then that kind of change in attitude might cause the offenders to think that they're being watched, and then the impact would really probably be from some kind of perception that the parole officers are doing something as opposed to the offender notification meeting. So, you know, I'm still working on it. Maybe if people believe Philip Hamburger's paper that institutional review boards are unconstitutional, we will be unencumbered by these, and I'll be able to ask these guys at some point. But somehow I don't think that's happening anytime soon.
very much.
All right.